you can still see the scarring from the last time that seismic testing was allowed, and only just a small portion of the refuge.
How would seismic surveys affect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 27th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a computer virus has disrupted Matsu Burrow services.
They attack indiscriminately. And so I really believe that here at the Matsu, we are probably simply collateral damage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by
BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska.
The first sign of oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is likely to be a 3D seismic survey. A company has applied to do the work, and the government has deemed the application complete. Everything about the proposal to drill in Anwar is controversial. Still, officials from the Bureau of Land Management said this week they see no need to do a full environmental impact statement for the seismic work and expect to approve the request in time for work to begin this winter. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Seismic work used to involve dynamite. Now it's mostly done with vibrating trucks that send shockwaves into the ground. Lines of sensors on the surface record the waves that bounce back to map underground formations. A company called SA Exploration wants to bring about a dozen vibrating vehicles to the refuge, each mounted on a rubber track. Several at a time would drive parallel lines across the frozen tundra. They'd stop frequently to lower their vibration plates for about 20 seconds and then move to the next spot. The trucks would drive about 8 lines across a typical square mile, according to the company's application. The plan is to shoot seismic across the entire coastal plain, or 2,600 square miles. Leslie Ellis Waters of the BLM says it's the same technology that was used west of the refuge in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska.
We felt that there would be insignificant impacts, so we're planning on doing an environmental assessment. And when that is available, we will post that environmental assessment with a draft finding of no significant impact.
An environmental assessment is kind of the junior cousin to a full environmental impact statement. It's less rigorous and less detailed. Waters says if the BLM learns something unexpected in the assessment or in the public comment period that follows, it could order a more thorough review.
At the end of the 30-day public comment period, if we don't receive substantial input to change our finding of no significant impact, we would issue a decision record and then the activity could be authorized.
In addition to the vibration trucks, the work will require 2 mobile camps, each able to house 160 people, and a variety of support vehicles. Attorney Jason Rylander at Defenders of Wildlife says the activity is far from harmless.
In fact, you can still see the scarring from the last time that seismic testing was allowed, and only just a small portion of the refuge.
In the 1980s, Congress allowed a 2D seismic survey on the coastal plain of the refuge, resulting in more than 1,000 miles of trails. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says most of the trails recovered well in the first decade, but a few miles were still visible from the air decades later. Data collection for a 3D seismic survey is more intensive, with far more sensors. Rylander and other environmentalists say they're especially worried about the impact seismic work could have on polar bears.
During denning season, it can cause mother polar bears to leave their den. It can expose polar bear cubs to disturbance. And so we're very, very concerned considering there's only 900 or fewer polar bears in the southern Beaufort Sea population.
That figure, 900 polar bears, is an estimate. And like most everything in the Arctic Refuge, it's disputed. But the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says noise disturbance and passing vehicles have prompted some mother polar bears to abandon their dens, while others seem to adjust to industrial noise. The Interior Department hopes to offer leases for drilling in Anwar next year. While it's responding to the application to conduct seismic work, BLM is also preparing a separate environmental impact statement for the lease sale itself. Congress last year mandated the lease sale, but Rylander says environmental groups aren't giving up.
Whether the Trump administration ultimately issues a lease or not, our aim is to ensure that this land is never drilled.
BLM expects to hold another public comment period and at least 7 public meetings on the lease sale proposal this fall or winter. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Salvage efforts are underway for the tender that sank near Clark's Point on Wednesday. What caused the 58-foot vessel to capsize is still under investigation. Divers were on scene to assess the situation yesterday and today. According to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, when the vessel sank, it had 1,100 gallons of diesel and hydraulic fuel aboard. Some of that fuel spilled, but how much spilled is unknown. Out of concern that fuel on the water could contaminate fish and fishing gear, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed the Nooshigak District to commercial salmon fishing. This afternoon, the Igooshik section of the district only reopened to set and drift gillnet gear. Area management biologist Tim Sands flew aerial surveys yesterday and today to monitor the situation.
We flew and saw less fuel coming off the vessel, and it was dispersing quicker.
That gave him confidence that the Igooshik section of the district is not at risk of contamination from fuel. Sands said that he will be monitoring the rest of the district to see when it will be safe to reopen to commercial fishing.
It's a day-by-day situation. We're going to fly it again tomorrow, hopefully, and kind of keep communicating with the other entities involved.
The owner of the FV Pacific Knight, a Petersburg-based company called Lone Fisherman Incorporated, is contracting with Resolve Marine to salvage the boat. In a situation report, DEC said that the fuel in the water may place more than a dozen species of birds and marine wildlife at risk, including several listed on the Endangered Species Act. One person who was on board the Pacific Knight when it went down is still missing, 59-year-old John Phillips of Juneau. The Matanuska Susitna Borough was hit hard with a computer virus this week that has disrupted some borough services. That includes outages for borough phones, email, and computers, which network managers took offline as they try to isolate the virus and prevent their systems from being further compromised. The borough says several departments unable to use their computers have turned to more manual systems, like using typewriters or handwriting receipts. IT Director Eric Wyatt says the virus's disruption is serious enough that it constitutes a cybercrime, and the FBI's cybercrimes unit has been investigating. Wyatt says it's so far unclear if the virus is causing borough computers to send private information elsewhere.
Well, that's always possible with these types of viruses, and that's part of our investigation. Did this virus get inside and send information outside? That is a common pattern of a lot of these viruses, so we are investigating that.
Wyatt says the borough does not store credit card information on servers that are connected to the internet. Resident information like property records are already available publicly anyway. But he says there is the possibility that personal information of borough employees could have been accessed. Wyatt says it seems unlikely the virus specifically targeted the Matsu borough. Instead, he thinks it was probably written to attack government computers in general, released onto the internet, and happened to find a way into the borough's systems through a fraudulent email known as a phishing attack.
They attack indiscriminately, and so I really believe that here at the Matsu, we are probably simply collateral damage.
Wyatt says his team has been able to slowly bring some systems online, but the disruptions could last as long as 3 weeks. A woman suspected of fraudulently applying for $70,000 in Alaska Permanent Fund dividends pleaded not guilty at her arraignment. The Associated Press reports 44-year-old Sheila McMahon entered the plea Thursday in Anchorage Superior Court. She faces one count of scheming to defraud and 148 counts of unsworn falsification. Assistant District Attorney Lisa Kelly says McMahon was arrested this month in her home state of Alabama. A warrant for her arrest was issued after the State Office of Special Prosecution said Ms. McMahon sought dozens of dividend checks from 2015 to 2017 on behalf of more than 50 people. The state issued about $17,000 in checks. Online court records do not list McMahon's attorney. She has been jailed at Highland Mountain Correctional Facility since July 19th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new grant looks to aid Alaskans with food insecurity.
Oftentimes, some of the agencies that we distribute food to don't have adequate refrigeration to take as much that we can provide for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station, ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is proceeding with an environmental review of the proposed Pebble Mine in southwest Alaska, despite a request from Governor Bill Walker that the review be halted. Governor Walker last month said the company behind the proposed copper and gold mine had yet to show that the project is feasible or realistic. He argued that, at a minimum, a preliminary economic assessment should be conducted. But Shane McCoy, the Corps' program manager for the Pebble Review, says an economic analysis is not one of the required pieces of information that the Corps needs to conduct its work. He says there are limited situations in which a review could be suspended, and that Walker's request did not fall within those. The Texalda Hill wildfire near Tok gained another 1,000 acres yesterday and has now charred over 13,000 acres. The State Division of Forestry reports that 113 firefighters are working to protect area native land allotments and cabins from the flames. The fire is about 38 miles southeast of Tok and 14 miles southwest of the village of Northway. Forestry is holding a public meeting tonight in Northway to update area residents on the situation. Other fires getting attention include the Andrews Creek Fire in the Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve. That blaze has experienced major growth, according to an Alaska Fire Service post. The AFS says the Andrews Creek Fire is now estimated to have burned 4,800 acres. It's located near the Dome Creek Fire and three other wildfires in the vicinity of historic Coal Creek Mining Camp. The AFS reports progress establishing line on the Hughes Mountain Fire. The blaze across the Koyukuk River from the village of Hughes remained at about 30 acres yesterday. Structure protection continues on private properties near the Zitziana River Fire south of Manly Hot Springs. That blaze and the neighboring Moose Heart Fire have together burned 115,000 acres. Bears twice made contact with humans last week in Brooks Camp at Katmai National Park and Preserve. In a written statement, the park called both incidents minor. One bear approached a visitor and pawed the person's pant leg. A different bear pawed an employee of Katmai Land's Brooks Lodge. It was being chased by another bear. Neither incident caused injury, but it's significant because the last known bear contact with a visitor there was over 20 years ago. The bears in both encounters were young. The park noted that this summer has seen unusually high numbers of young bears that have recently separated from their mothers, and that subadult bears are more likely to interact with people. Around 1 in 8 Alaskans have wondered at some point in the last year where their next meal will come from, according to the USDA. In some parts of rural Alaska, rates of food insecurity are as high as 27%. Senator Lisa Murkowski added a grant program to the Senate Farm Bill that aims, in its own small way, to help. The microgrants for food security program would give individuals up to $5,000 and organizations up to $10,000 to address food insecurity in their communities. Organizations like the Food Bank of Alaska could benefit from the program. CEO Jim Baldwin says the money could be used to fund training and education, invest in new technologies, or build a community garden or smokehouse.
And if there's an entrepreneur out there that has an idea on how to grow produce or do hydroponics or start some kind of a canning operation, this could really be a seed money to get something up and going that's sustainable.
He says the program could also help the Food Bank of Alaska start a canning program of its own to preserve excess food and help partner organizations purchase refrigeration equipment. The food bank serves as a hub for food distribution to community organizations across the state.
Oftentimes, some of the agencies that we distribute food to don't have adequate refrigeration to take as much that we can provide for them.
Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and several islands in the Pacific would be eligible. Alaska is slated to receive a total of $4 million in grants a year. Baldwin says Alaska's rural nature and geographic isolation make community efforts produce and process food locally that much more important for food security. Kara Durr is the Director of Public Engagement for the Food Bank of Alaska and a board member for the Alaska Food Policy Council. The House version of the Farm Bill cuts the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as food stamps. But Durr says she's hopeful this program will make it into the final version.
We want to make sure that a final Farm Bill is strong for Alaska. It's strong and supports the nutrition titles, including SNAP, so no additional cuts to that program or onerous requirements that would make people fall off the program. Supports local ag, and I see this provision as being a really nice complement.
The House and the Senate have passed different versions of the Farm Bill and will try to hash out a compromise in the coming months. The law covers everything from food assistance to rural development to crop insurance.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Early. This week on AK, stepping into adulthood. This summer, high school graduates from all over the state are moving beyond their childhood, whether that's furthering their education, entering the workforce, or just exploring life. But as KFSK's Angela Denning reports, one Petersburg graduate has had to overcome challenges to get to this point.
Zach Christensen is helping his uncle Lars garden. The lanky 18-year-old lives with his uncle on Petersburg's main highway. They pulled speakers out onto the concrete front steps to listen while they work. In the corner of the yard, near the road, there's a strawberry patch that's overrun with weeds. Zach leans over and pulls out handfuls of green grass. He's no stranger to manual labor. Staying active is actually the doctor's orders for his cerebral palsy.
Work hard so body will build up a little bit there. Keep the muscles I need strengthened.
He also goes to the gym to weightlift.
Through my life, I've learned that I just gotta keep proving people wrong that I can do all these things I want to do and go places.
He has big plans. He wants to start a life in northeastern Montana where his extended family lives. The town is Marion, with about 300 residents.
I'm not a big fan of big crowds or big cities or anything like that. Just ask my mom, when I gotta go through crowds, I just turn into a horrible person.
He's an outdoors boy. He doesn't like the city.
That's Zach's mom, Molly Christensen. When Zach was born, doctors told her he might not be able to do things like other children.
He may not walk. He may not ever talk. He might be a vegetable. And he ended up defying all the odds.
But it hasn't been an easy road. Zach had seizures for the first 6 months of his life before medication ended them. Fine motor skills remain difficult, like writing. He's relied on typing, and in school, he had an aide that he could dictate notes to.
Carrying a plate, having a drink in his hand, anything that requires dexterity has always been a huge challenge for him.
Growing up, Zach had all kinds of therapy. Physical, occupational, speech. And in a town of 3,000, that therapy wasn't always close to home. In the eighth grade, his mom flew him to Portland, Oregon every week for nearly a year. They'd fly down on Sunday, see doctors Monday, and return to Alaska on Tuesday.
That was a really crazy year. Zach got real burned out with flying.
Got very old.
Molly decided that traveling from Petersburg, where she had family support and Zach had friends, was better than moving for temporary medical care. And in the end, the therapy set him on a path to being more physically independent. He wrestled and played baseball as a teenager. He says the Petersburg School has been very supportive over the years, and it showed at graduation, the day he got his diploma.
Zachary M. Christensen.
I really appreciate it. I might not always show it, especially with this fry. She's on my back a lot about grades. I'm graduating high school, probably thanks to her.
Cindy Fry has worked with Zach in the high school for 3 years through the special education department. She says Zach has a tenacious determination, not letting his disability get in the way of being successful.
Zach does not let anything really stop him. He gets his mind on a goal and he'll make it happen.
His goal now is to move to Montana as a diesel mechanic. He's enrolled in a 10-month vocational technical school, AvTech, in Seward. Zach says he enjoyed tearing apart and rebuilding a lawnmower in his high school shop class.
I just always love vehicles, and I like working with my hands.
Fry has been in contact with the Votech school about Zach's needs and says they have resources for him, like iPads for typing notes. He'll also bring wrist weights for helping with stabilization. She says the bigger challenge will be Zach advocating for himself.
Part of the message as they get to seniors is, okay, so how are you going to advocate this when you're an adult? What are you going to do? What are you going to say? Who are you going to go to? And that's some of the things that we work on.
Zach's mom thinks he'll do just fine.
He started off life almost losing his. When he got it back, that gave him a determination to thrive and live.
Back in the garden, Zach says after he finishes weeding, he's going to pack for a 3-day camping trip with friends.
You know, every kid needs to spread his wings, figure out where he's going. I'm excited, man. I'm ready to get out into the world, start the next chapter, see where life will take me.
Zach will have some familiar company at AvTech. Another Petersburg graduate is joining him there. This summer, though, Zach will be making money at a cannery in Kisilov. With a laugh, he says he's going to be the official tote washer there. For AK, I'm Angela Denning.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Janine Driscoll in Gustavus. Driscoll was one of the founders of the Gustavus Community Garden.
Oh, the years just passed by. I'm going to guess we started this garden somewhere in the ballpark of 10 years ago. Maybe 15. Who knows? A long time. We got inspired to start a community garden for two reasons. One is the moose in Gustavus started hammering everyone's garden. They started eating the peas, the cabbages, the kale, and it was like, wow, we need a fence. So we've got this fenced-in area where there's about 21 plots inside the fence, the moose fence, and then there's plots outside the moose fence, and those are particularly for potatoes. And we grow potatoes on one side 1 year and then on the opposite side the following year so we can rotate a little bit to prevent scab. What does the best here? Things that like it cool and wet. So basically your kale and cabbages, peas grow really well, but so do a lot of the flowers. And so we have a vast amount of little plots that have some of the perennials in as well. Challenges gardening right here and just in anywhere in Southeast is that it's just really wet. The soil's not very fertile. The temperatures stay so cold. And so the ground stays cold. And so that's why a lot of the people here have raised beds to try to warm the soil a little faster. And here at the garden, we have a fair amount of wind. And so you could look around and see that it almost looks like they're Calistoga wagons here as we're putting up the Remay underneath the hoops to prevent the damage from wind. It's a friend's birthday tomorrow, and so his wife asks that his friends write haiku to help him celebrate his birthday. I do have some garden haiku. So the first one goes, the promise of hope, a simple seed in the ground, broccoli for lunch. The other one, you need to look at my trellis in order to understand, but oh, the joy it is, strands of hypogymnia on my pea trellis. Hypogymnia is a type of lichen, and I sometimes harvest lichen to be able to use it to dye fibers. And so lichen plays a certain place in my role in my life, shall we say.
Janine Driscoll lives in Gustavus. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Angela Denning and Scott Burton. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Earth.
Before we close out tonight's program, an announcement. Lori Townsend, Alaska Public Media's news director, my boss, and the longtime host of Alaska News Nightly, joins me for a moment. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Casey. It's kind of weird to be on this side of the anchor desk. But yes, after 15 years of me as your daily host of Alaska News Nightly, I am passing the torch to Casey. Not because I'm leaving. I'll still be on hand for Talk of Alaska and Alaska Insight. And don't forget, Casey, I'm still your boss. But change is good. And Casey, you're a lifelong Alaskan. You've been a reporter for us for more than a year now, and certainly a reporter with a long tenure before that. And you've had a long connection to Alaska News Nightly as a listener, right?
Yeah, it's funny because when I first watched you hosting this show, it sort of transported me back to my dad's car when I was a little kid. We used to listen to Alaska News Nightly on our drive home. It was so weird. I was in the booth watching you and listening, and I could like smell my dad's old car. And, you know, my mom and dad and stepmom have always had the radio dials tuned to this program for as long as I can remember. So it's just an honor to do this. And it feels like these are some big shoes to fill. I'll be doing my best to deliver the news in the calm, measured way that I've heard you do it. Now, I have a question for you. What does it mean to you to have hosted Alaska News Nightly all this time?
Wow, it's really been a lot of fun. It's been a great honor for me to deliver the news every day to Alaskans, to be here to clarify some of the biggest stories through the years, both the tragic events and happy occasions. Alaska is such a unique state with incredible stories everywhere you look, and I know that you'll uphold our strong commitment to our statewide mission.
Well, thanks for this opportunity. And you know what else?
What's that?
In the words of our friend BD Trantina, yippee, it's Friday, and let's wrap this up. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Avery Lill in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Aaron McKinstry in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.